All right, so the next and last call this morning, I mean before the break, is by Greg Enk at John Hopkins about turbulent Lagrangian dynamics of vortex and magnetic field lines, right?
Okay, yes. Thank you for the introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here. So my talk is going to have two parts. So in the first part, I'm going to discuss a theoretical problem. And in the second part, I'm actually going to present what I think is the resolution of the problem. And to actually set up the problem, it's very nice to actually look at a discussion in Feynman's lectures on physics. Okay, so you may not know that Feynman thought it was a worthwhile subject for a freshman at Caltech to talk about the limit of zero viscosity in turbulent flow. So it's actually a very interesting discussion. I encourage you to read the entire thing. I don't have time to go through even this entire passage here, but I would like to focus on this paragraph where he said, well, you may be wondering, you know, what is fine-grained turbulence and how does it maintain itself? And he presented an answer where he said the answer is, again, interesting. He said vorticity has a tendency to amplify itself. He said if we forget for a moment about diffusion of vorticity, which causes a loss, the laws of flow, as we have seen, say that the vortex lines are carried along with the fluid at the velocity v. And actually, you'll notice that I've emphasized certain passages here that are certain lines that are going to be important in what I say. He said, we can imagine a certain number of lines of omega which are being distorted and twisted by the complicated flow pattern of v. This pulls the lines closer together and mixes them all up. The lines that were simple before will get knotted and pulled closer together. They will be longer and tighter together. The strength of the vorticity will increase, and its irregularities and pluses and minuses will in general increase. So the magnitude of vorticity in three dimensions increases as we twist the fluid about. Okay, so here's Feynman's version of it. But I mean, I could have cited many other people. This is a very common argument. You can see it in Tennyson, Lumley, Batchelor, Onsugger. Many other people made this argument. And its original paternity, in fact, seems to be G.I. Taylor. Going back to 1917, but he gave very explicit discussions in the 30s, and there are sort of three elements of this idea of Taylor, which is that in the limit of high Reynolds number, vortex lines should move approximately as material lines. Material lines will tend to lengthen dramatically as well as twist and fold. And also that the vorticity magnitudes will therefore increase because by conservation of circulation, as they get longer, the magnitude will get greater proportional to the length of the line. And these ideas of Taylor were also imported to MHD by his student Batchelor in around 1950, but with vortex lines replaced by magnetic field lines and Kelvin theorem replaced by the Alphane theorem on conservation of magnetic flux or flux freezing. However, there are some problems with this. Okay, and the major theoretical problem is, in fact, the Kelvin theorem. We need the Kelvin theorem for items 1 and 3 in that list. In order to have approximately frozen in lines, in order to have the circulation, I mean the vorticity strengths increasing as we stretch the lines, we need to have the Kelvin theorem being valid. And unfortunately, in the presence of viscosity, that theorem is no longer naively valid. And this is also discussed as well by these great guys. I mean, so Feynman discussed similar issues. He was actually looking at the vorticity equation itself. But all of his discussion there works as well. And he said, well, you know, actually, there are higher order gradients, and this term doesn't have to vanish in the limit of small viscosity. And Taylor and Green made similar observations in their 1937 paper, where they said, in general, you will not be able to neglect this term. Unfortunately, this is completely destructive of the earlier statements that they made, so we're actually being a little inconsistent here, because that actually means that we don't have the basis for 1 and 3.
Absolutely. We cannot forget about viscosity. Yeah.
You are on the next slide, Arkady. You are on the next slide. Okay. There have been many, therefore, empirical objections to Taylor. Okay, and so we know that there are lots of essential differences. I mean, people have observed in experiments and simulations. I probably have missed some references here. Arkady is one of the vocal people about this. You see, we agree about some things, you see. And I mean, I don't have time to go through all the experimental data here, but I mean, in particular, alignments of passive vectors and alignments of vorticity are different. There are substantial differences that one sees. Let me sort of go to a physical example where we can see some of the problem. And this is sort of in MHD flow. that there's a very ambiguous status of this theorem, because on the one hand, we want it to be true. So for example, in a dynamo, we believe that as we stretch out the magnetic field lines, that should transfer energy to the magnetic field lines. You should have more B squared. So we want it to be true there. On the other hand, in reconnection, like in a solar flare, we want it to break down so we can change the topology. And so we're in a position now where when we want it, we say it's okay. And when we want to violate it, we say we can violate it. And we don't have a rule for when we do and when we don't. Actually, it's even worse, because in dynamo, we also need reconnection. That's an essential part of the cycle as well. And so in that case, we both want it to be true and we want it to be false. Okay, now about 10 years ago, this perplexing situation got even worse. Okay, because about 10 years ago, this interesting phenomenon of spontaneous stochasticity was discovered. Now, I assume many people here in the audience have heard about this before, but let me give a little review to refresh everyone's mind, and also some people may have actually missed about this development. So what it was discovered about 10 years ago is that in a turbulent flow, because of the roughness of the velocity field, in the limit of infinite Reynolds number, the uniqueness of the Lagrangian trajectories breaks down. Okay, and let me sort of explain what actually happens. It's a consequence of what Eberhard was talking about, Richardson diffusion. So if I start off two particles initially separated by a distance rho, but in the inertial range, so a distance is much bigger than eta, they separate to a mean square length, RMS length, proportional to t to the 3/2 power, that's independent of this separation. That's what the prediction is. And therefore, for either long times, this thing scales like that, or alternatively, I could consider taking smaller and smaller viscosities, and then smaller and smaller rho. And in the limit, I have the two particles starting off at the same point and ending up at different places. Okay. That.
How do you take the limit? Because it's inertial range.
That's what I'm talking about, inertial range. You've got the point exactly. I can take, you just missed my statement. I can either take long times in the inertial range, or I can consider higher and higher Reynolds number. Those are my limits. Okay? This is a theorem for the Krejcian model, which I'll tell you about next. Navier-Stokes, well, Eberhard will keep pushing this. Okay, anyways. But this is just a simple consequence of Richardson two-particle diffusion. Now, this was originally discovered, I believe, as far as I know the literature, by Bernard, Gwetzky, and Kupiainen in 1998 in the context of the Krejcian model. That's an artificial random advection model in which you assume that the velocity field is Gaussian and it's delta correlated in time. The spatial part, let's for simplicity assume, is given by a simple Richardson scaling. That would give the usual familiar T cubed law. And in that case, with this is actually for some length scale in an inertial range, then we're going to cut it off at some pseudo-dissipation scale. And there are a number of ways of discussing this there, but in particular, if we smooth this off and we make it smooth at some scale, we now can have well-defined unique trajectories. But if I take my initial conditions to be random, and then I take the double limit where I first of all let the Reynolds number go to limit where I'm now sampling in a finite volume rho, and then I let that volume rho go to zero, they do not collapse to a single trajectory. In fact, what's remarkable in the Krejcian model is that they actually give a universal distribution, a nice random distribution. It depends on the particular velocity field that you're looking at, but it doesn't depend on exactly how you sample the particles in this ball of volume rho. In other words, you look at all the particles sampled there. It doesn't matter how you do it. From any smooth distribution, it's fine. This is a completely different way than in which randomness usually appears in our subject. Okay? So we're very familiar with randomness that comes by averaging over the velocity field. You have a random ensemble of velocity fields. This is totally different. This is something completely new, because this is for a fixed velocity realization. The particle trajectories become random. Okay? That's why it's called spontaneous stochasticity. The stochasticity emerges spontaneously because of the fact that you have a rough velocity field. By the way, this is a very well-known phenomenon in modern theory of differential equations. It doesn't have anything to do with the fact that this is delta correlated. There are many simple examples of this that are known in the literature in ordinary differential equations. It's called the superposition principle in some of the modern literature. Okay, now let me say another approach, how this can be seen in the Krejcian model. This is in some ways a little less physical because in reality we don't have a little Brownian motion acting on fluid particles, but it's very nice mathematical and it does have good physical connections. And that is that we can add a little bit of Brownian motion to our fluid particle trajectories. And now we get essentially the same picture, except now I can start off at the same point exactly, but I take different realizations of the Brownian motion. And the important point here is that when I do that and I take the limit of diffusivity vanishing, the trajectories do not collapse again to a single trajectory. In fact, if I take two particles out of that ensemble, two independent realizations out of that ensemble, and I look at their mean square separation, again, they separate like T3 halves, so the Richardson diffusion scaling again. And what's interesting also is if I now look at the transition probability here for this simple stochastic ODE, that's a completely well-defined object. And when I take the kappa going to zero limit, that converges, at least in the incompressible case, to exactly the same universal distribution that I got by this other procedure over here. Precisely the same thing. So it's very robust. Now, as I said, there is some nice physical connection here, which has to do with passive scalar mixing. So as is well known by many people here, Brian Sofford has written an entire review about this sort of thing. It's well known. You can actually use this randomness to get the effect of molecular mixing. So in order to represent the solution of this equation, I can actually put in that random Brownian motion. And then the solution is just represented by averaging the initial data with respect to that transition probability going backward in time. Then I can take the limit as diffusivity goes to zero, and I get a singular solution of this passive advection equation. But again, one in which the mixing does not disappear. So now molecular mixing is replaced by turbidant mixing, and that's why this equation remains dissipative. So this particular equation actually continues to dissipate scalar substance, and it's because the molecular mixing is replaced by turbidant mixing. So again, these are all theorems for the Kraichian model. But I would say this poses a big crisis to our understanding of vortex dynamics. In particular, all the three ideas of Taylor are now even more questionable, because what do we mean to say that the vortex lines are frozen in if they're not even unique? There's no unique Lagrangian trajectory. Do material lines even exist for nu equal to zero? After all, since infinitesimally close points can separate, maybe the whole line just explodes into some disconnected cloud of particles. And can the Kelvin theorem be valid if material loops, which are basic in the formulation of the theorem, become random or maybe even ill-defined? Okay, so now the situation looks even worse. Okay. However, I'm going to argue that, in fact, these recent results in the Kraichian model, in fact, give us the key to understanding what's really going on. Okay, so I'm now going to present a possible solution. I've actually presented this already in the literature. Some people here in the audience have heard me talk about this before. And I've given already 2 years ago what I thought was a good answer for this. But I'm going to actually now use some more recent results to try to give even a somewhat stronger argument for it. And this is actually not my work. This is beautiful work of Peter Constantine, already from a couple of years ago, but just recently published. And he's shown that there is a stochastic Kelvin theorem for the Navier-Stokes equation. And so let me explain the stochastic Kelvin theorem. You now take this stochastic equation, okay, but we're going to solve it backward in time. So I take my loop at the final time, and I evolve it backward in time, and I get this random ensemble of loops, and I take the circulations over each of those loops, and I average them together, and that gives me the circulation on the final loop. So the Navier-Stokes equation satisfies that property. Furthermore, that property characterizes the Navier-Stokes equation. A velocity field can satisfy this property if and only if it's a solution of the Navier-Stokes equation. So it's another equivalent formulation of the Navier-Stokes equation. This is an amazing result. It actually is a kind of nonlinear fixed point characterization of the Navier-Stokes equation, because the same velocity field that emerges from the average is also the velocity field that advects the particles. Okay, now they also proved another nice result. Pardon? The velocity that emerges from this average is the same velocity that advects the particles in the random equation. So in that sense, it's a nonlinear fixed point condition that such a thing should be true.
How do you get the velocity from the average of the velocity?
Pardon?
How do you get the velocity?
That's why it's a nonlinear fixed point condition. You have to find a velocity field that satisfies this property. It's a self-consistency statement. And it is equivalent. The only solution to this problem is a solution of the Navier-Stokes equation.
You have to think of viscosity converging it to this fixed point.
I don't know what that means. I
mean,
There's no limit. This is just a restatement of the Navier-Stokes equation. Okay, now there's another way of formulating this in terms of vorticity. It's actually easiest to describe this in terms of forward stochastic flows, where we take the same equation and solve it forward, and then to pull things backward in time, we use the inverse map, or back to labels map. And in that case, you get a stochastic version of the Cauchy formula for the vorticity. And so what you do is you actually go back and you look at all the vorticity vectors that end up in that final point, and you average them together, and that gives you the Navier-Stokes solution for the vorticity. Let me actually show that with a picture. Okay. So actually, I'm going to argue this is actually a very beautiful way of understanding viscous vortex reconnection. You take the vorticity vectors at the beginning, and you're looking at a set of trajectories that all end up in this given point. In reality, I'm looking at three, but you want to look at all, you know, the whole ensemble of these. You transport the vector just as you would for Euler dynamics with the Cauchy formula to the final point, which of course rotates them and stretches them. You then average over that whole ensemble, and that gives you the actual vorticity field that comes from solving the Navier-Stokes equation.
Great. And that Navier-Stokes equation, the velocity field itself is smooth?
Of course, yeah. The velocity field in the Navier-Stokes equation is smooth.
So you're actually, I mean, it's not quite the same as you discussed before, the non-uniqueness of trajectories, because...
No, you've missed the point, because in fact the non-uniqueness emerged by taking a limit. I am not talking about zero viscosity limit yet, but in fact the non-uniqueness emerges from looking at smooth solutions. That was the whole point that I made right here. This is a smooth velocity field, and you take a suitable limit, and then the non-uniqueness emerges. Of course, for any fixed realization, I mean, for any finite, you know, any finite degree of smoothness, they're unique, of course.
But can you relate it to that previous statements about non-smooth velocity?
I just did here. I just did that. Sorry, I mean, I just did that. This is a rough velocity field that's been smoothed on small scale. And in the suitable limit, which of course is what means when you take the viscosity smaller and smaller, then it becomes rough. And then you see the non-uniqueness appearing in the kind of operation that I did here. Sample in a small volume, let the Reynolds number go to infinity first, then let the particles get closer and closer together, and the trajectories are not unique.
Sorry, just 1 second. Could you see?
Maybe I should be able to finish my story before you ask a lot of questions. Sorry.
Could you postpone the discussion?
Because otherwise I'm not going to finish.
All right. Thank you.
We're both going to be alive a long time. You have a lot of chance to ask me questions. Okay.
But I mean, this model was...
this is not a model. I'm just giving you facts about the Navier-Stokes equation. These are just facts about the Navier-Stokes equation. Yes, please. Okay. By the way, these are real trajectories in the sense that these are actually trajectories that I solved in a 1024 cube simulation by adding in viscosity. So I just thought I would show you some real ones. These I generated with our turbulence database at Hopkins. But anyways, so this is actually what these trajectories would look like for a Navier-Stokes solution when you add in this little Brownian motion. Anyways, that's not particularly important. By the way, this does actually then give you the basic mechanism of viscous vortex reconnection, because if I take two vortex lines that start off like this and they get vectored close together, well, when you average those over the random ensemble, of course, this part here cancels out and you get zero, and they end up looking instead like, you know, like this. So basically, it's this average here which is going to change the topology, and that's what's giving you the viscous reconnection. So this is just a simple, intuitive way of looking at how the reconnection actually happens. Okay, now we can talk about the zero viscosity limit. And let me rewrite the stochastic Kelvin theorem by looking at the transition probability on loops. So I take the circulation on a given loop, and I now take this transition probability on the loops for the Navier-Stokes solution. And this is an exact result. This is a theorem. And then, as I had argued earlier, in the limit as viscosity goes to zero, this transition probability should converge to a non-trivial limit, just like it does for the passive scalar problem. Actually, this combines both limits, because I'm now having, as you said, a smooth velocity, and I've added random noise, because the Navier-Stokes solution is smooth. And then I add random noise. But in fact, in the Krejcian model, you can do both together, and you still get the same limit. Okay. So again, that's the argument here, is that this thing will converge to that. Okay. Anyways, so then this is the proposal for what should replace the Kelvin theorem and the limit of high Reynolds number. And you'll notice that in some sense that it resolves the essential problem, because now we have our cake and we eat it too. We see in what way the circulations are preserved. They're preserved in an average sense. So that is, the circulation at the final time is the average of the circulations at the earlier times. But we also get to break we also get to violate it too, because we get the topology change that we need. Okay, so we can get reconnection. So this version seems to, you know, to solve all the paradoxes. Now, I just want to mention quickly that there is a connection with this old conjecture of Ansager that the zero viscosity limit should be an Euler solution. This is rather amusing. Actually, I just submitted a paper to Physica D. This is your special issue, Srini, in which I show that this Constantine E, or nonlinear fixed point characterization, is actually a stochastic principle of least action. And I don't have time to explain all that here, but basically you take the usual familiar action, but you average it over the realizations of the Brownian motion with also a random velocity field. And what I've shown is that the Navier-Stokes equation is the stationary point of this action. Okay. So it gives another way of formulating the Constantine-Ehr result. And furthermore, what's interesting is that the stochastic Kelvin theorem that they proved can be shown to be a consequence of the particle relabeling symmetry of the action. So you have an infinite dimensional symmetry group that is known to give the Kelvin theorem and the Euler equation, and that same symmetry gives this stochastic version that Constantine and Ehr derived. So it's actually, I cannot yet control the zero viscosity limit. I don't think anyone can mathematically yet. But it's actually quite amusing that in this approach, even for positive viscosity, there's a strong analogy to ideal Euler. Okay, now let me just say that there are MHD analogs of all these results. This is work that I'm now writing up with Antonio Netto, a postdoc. And we here I've given the result for standard MHD, although we can also prove it for two-fluid model, Hall MHD, and for Anik, I'll say we can also do alpha MHD. But here let me just state the result for ordinary MHD. And it's a very similar statement where it says that if I look at the magnetic flux on a given, here I've given magnetic flux in terms of the vector potential, sorry, because I wanted to keep these as line integrals. So I used the vector potential. But the magnetic flux at the later time on the given loop is just the average over the magnetic flux at all the earlier times. And then there's also a version of the Kelvin theorem. Now, this is actually a randomized version of a generalized Kelvin theorem that many of the people here in the MHD community probably know about, due to Bekenstein and Oren and Kuznetsov and Rubin. And they realize that there's a little extra piece that you can add into the ordinary Kelvin theorem that accounts for the Lorentz force. And I don't think this thing has a name, so I've taken the liberty of naming it. It called it the Lagrangian history charge density. And it's a vector, and if I take that vector and I dot it into a little local infinitesimal area element vector, then that gives me the charge that is swept out by that area as it evolves in a Lagrangian fashion from time t prime to time t. So from the initial time t prime to the final time t, it just gives the charge that's swept out in an algebraic sense. And if you add that term in, that actually corrects for the Lorentz force, and you get another Lagrangian variant, and actually also have another set of frozen-in lines in MHD. So not only are magnetic field lines frozen in, but you have another set of frozen-in lines as well. And by taking into account those two frozen-in properties, you actually account for the Lorentz force. By the way, this new conservation law also emerges from particle relabeling symmetry, so that was also discussed by Kuznetsov and Rubin. Okay, so we have a stochastic version of that in exactly the same sense. And there's also a stochastic Lundquist formula, which is just the analog of the Cauchy formula for the vorticity. So everything is exactly the same. And you get exactly the same picture of magnetic reconnection that you have for vortex reconnection. Oh, I did have to mention one thing here, sorry. So far we can only prove this for unit Prandtl number. That's not necessarily a big problem. We'll have to discuss that with MHD people. But anyways, at the moment, that's all we could show. I mean, this whole picture of stochasticity doesn't depend on this random picture anyways. It's a more general phenomenon. But anyways, this is a useful formalism. And so far, we can only apply it for unit Prandtl number. Okay, so now let me make a remark about magnetic dynamo in the context of this general formalism. There was a very nice observation published a couple of years ago by Celani, Massino, and Vincenzi, in which they actually made an interesting observation about the threshold for kinematic dynamo effect in the Krejcin-Kazantsev model. So that's actually the model, just like the Krejcin model, in which you advect things with this white noise velocity field. It's a very popular model of turbulent kinematic dynamo. And they actually noticed that the threshold of roughness of the velocity field for transition to dynamo is closely connected with the properties of little infinitesimal material line elements. And so basically, if I look at two little infinitesimal material line elements and I advect them forward in the flow, well, of course, they get stretched and rotated. And what they found is that there's a critical degree of roughness that if the velocity field is too rough, they become strongly decorrelated. They become so strongly decorrelated that in the limit where I let rho go to zero, the correlation goes to zero. So they're totally uncorrelated in the limit where they start off at the same point. Okay? And it's precisely at that critical degree of roughness that the dynamo action stops. So when you go below that, it's too rough and the decorrelation is too strong. It is in three dimensions, in arbitrary. I mean, actually, we've extended their result to D dimension just because we were interested in it. For the three dimension, the critical roughness is one, unity. But in general, it's not. Actually, there's a little bit more story about this that we could talk about privately. So anyways, there's something interesting that happens in one in every dimension, but it's not the dynamo transition. So actually, I mean, we can sort of understand this in terms of this picture. Because you see what happens is when those magnetic field lines get advected in, they've been stretched and rotated all over the place. If they're too strongly angularly decorrelated, when you average them, it almost goes to zero. Okay? And so you suppress the growth. So individual line elements always grow. I mean, on average. I mean, they don't always grow. But on average, every individual line element tracking by itself always grows. But the point is that when you average them together, then you get a lot of cancellation. So that's the critical factor in the dynamo action. Okay, now, it's important here to see the effect of resistivity. The effect of resistivity is there, and so let me make just a comment about that. Resistivity obviously plays an important role here, and one way of seeing that is saying, well, what happens if I put in negative resistivity? In that case, you know, you might naively think, well, negative resistivity puts energy into the magnetic field, right? And so you might expect that it would make the dynamo effect stronger. But in fact, negative resistivity is the time reverse of the positive resistivity solution. So if I take a solution that's showing dynamo effect and the magnetic field is growing, when I take that and I stop it and I use that as an initial condition and then I put in negative resistivity, the magnetic field decays exponentially. So it's actually rather perplexing, the role of resistivity. Putting in something that enhances the gradients actually suppresses the dynamo effect. And in fact, in that case, this magnetic flux thing would be true for the negative resistivity case, backward in time, but forward in time. So in other words, it's very important that this property that I was talking about, this generalized Kelvin theorem, is done in a causal way. You have to average over past values of the magnetic flux. That's the causal direction. You should not average over future values. And I should say that this role of resistivity in the dynamo effect is actually quite well known. Moffat already discussed it in 1978, where he referred to it as an oxymoronic role, a paradoxical role, where magnetic dynamo effect is regenerative decay or reinvigorating dissipation. So that averaging plays a crucial role. Okay, now I'm almost finished. Let me just say that, of course, I now suspect that, you know, we can make the same conjectures about zero resistivity limit. For finite resistivity with unit Prandtl number at least, this is a theorem. And then the question is, what happens in the limit of small resistivity? And again, the same argument is that you don't expect that those effects will disappear because of spontaneous stochasticity. Everything should stay random. And you expect that in the limit, the Alphane theorem is replaced by a generalized Alphane theorem, in which you have to average over a random ensemble of past magnetic fluxes. So molecular mixing should be replaced by turbulent mixing. Now, the crucial question is, how fast is this particle separation? That's an open question for MHD. In the Krejcin-Kazantsev kinematic dynamo, it's a theorem. We know that the turbulent velocity field diffuses mean square relative distances not proportional to resistivity times the time, but instead proportional to the epsilon t cubed Richardson diffusion. So it's completely different than what you would get from simple laminar estimates. This is very common in the astrophysics community. And I'm just going to end there and say, here are some directions that I think are important for future work. I think that, as Eberhard discussed, I mean, first of all, I should emphasize, spontaneous stochasticity is a real physical phenomenon. We should be able to see it in the laboratory. Hopefully, Eberhard will see it in a coming generation of experiments. This is something that's very bizarre, but it really probably happens in turbulent flow. I think it's going to be hard to show mathematically, but hopefully we'll see it either from numeric experiment or simulation. Well, there are a lot of things that I think that have to be done. I think everybody can read this themselves. Many of these efforts are already going on. I mean, there have been posters and other discussions here at the meeting about various of these things. And I hope that this talk has just given some additional impetus and focus to those efforts. Thank you very much for your attention.
Before we give up on Kelvin's circulation theorem in its classical sense, I think you need to clarify the conditions that you're imposing on your velocity field as you take the limit, the viscosity going to zero and time being finite. Many of us would start with a smooth velocity field, and it would take either finite time for it to become rough, if there's a singularity, or it would take infinite time.
You're talking about Euler.
Euler.
I'm not talking about Euler. I mean, if I'm talking about smooth Euler, then of course I believe
I know there
in
was
Kelvin theorem.
Arcadi said right. Euler doesn't make any sense in 3D.
Pardon?
But if I started completely smooth in 3D, surely I can use Euler for a while.
Of course, I'm not crazy. I wouldn't adopt to that. I mean, the Kelvin theorem is a theorem then. So.
But there's then the circulation theorem holds until.
Of course.
Okay.
Of course, who would object to that?
Just physics is different.
You seem to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, of course, you missed the whole point. Of course, I'm not talking about that. For a smooth Euler solution, of course the Kelvin theorem holds. Why not?
I would like to refer to the.
You get the last comment before we break the coffee, right?
Point. You see, as you probably too believe, all real Navier-Stokes or just real flow fields. At any Reynolds number, whatever larger, smooth. No singularities, nothing like that.
For Navier-Stokes.
Yeah, sure. So this means that you never can, so you have a smooth field. Now, all this stochastic, spontaneous stochasticity is a result of assuming that the flow is rough.
No. It's rough in the inertial range.
No,
you missed the point. It's rough in the inertial range.
I mean, it's inertial range now doesn't have to take it. I mean, the whole flow field is not rough. It's smooth at any Reynolds number.
Rough, fine.
Okay, then nothing of spontaneous stochasticity can be expected.
No, you're wrong.
The point of Exxon lectures is to trigger discussion.
This is a theorem. This is a theorem, and this is stochastic. So for the Navier-Stokes equation at finite Reynolds number, you have to average over the ensemble of past loops. Okay, that's a theorem. Then the question becomes, how does this diffusion change as the viscosity gets smaller and smaller? Do all the loops collapse to a single loop, or does it stay spread out? I don't have to take a limit of infinite Reynolds number. I don't have to deal with actually rough velocity fields. You've missed the point. It's irrelevant. I'm talking about smooth things, but rough on the inertial range. As long as they're rough in the inertial range, you expect the phenomenon of spontaneous stochasticity for smooth velocity fields.
Okay, thank all the speakers for this morning, and we'll break them.